Welcome to Between the Rows, where you get to hear the stories behind the stories in Canada's leading farm publications.
Hello, and welcome to Between the Rows, your agriculture podcast from Glacier Farm Media. I'm your host this week, Manitoba Co-operator Editor Gord Gilmore. In this edition, we'll be speaking to Food in Canada editor Christy Nudz about the challenges food processors face meeting federal targets to grow agri-food exports. We'll also have Manitoba Co-operator reporter Geraldine Witchers joining us in the studio to tell us all about the vanishing agricultural icon that is the Old Red Barn. Bruce Burnett of Markets Farm will fill us in on the latest in the world of commodity markets at the end of the show. But up first is Glacier Farm Media machinery editor Scott Garvey. He's going to be telling us about a bold move by John Deere to place agriculture technology front and center at the world-famous Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas earlier this year. Scott, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Gord. It's great to be back.
So, a combine at the CES show. Can you tell us how that came about?
Yeah, it wasn't exactly what you'd expect to find if you were walking the halls at the Consumer Electronics Show, or you might be looking for cell phones and robots and automatic things of that nature. But John Deere decided that it was going to make its presence known to the tech world, and it brought probably the largest event or largest exhibit to ever grace the floor of that show. It brought an S700 series combine.
So, I mean, that's no small feat. I mean, first off, to get one out in the desert like that and then get it into a hotel ballroom and so forth. What was Deere hoping to accomplish with this unexpected move?
Well, Deere decided it wanted to show the world, or at least the tech world, that it was in no small means a tech player. So why not bring your most technical machine, and that is an S700 combine with the suite of technology that it has, and including artificial intelligence. So they brought the combine to the show and decided to introduce, or maybe reintroduce, agriculture to a large segment of the population that now knows less and less about what goes on outside the limits of a city.
And so how did a crowd that's more used to the latest phone or gaming system react to this?
Well, I'm told that quite literally people were stopped in their tracks as they came around the corner to see this machine, which most of them didn't know what it was. So Deere was able to introduce this machine as both a technological marvel and show the urban population what's really going on in agriculture today.
And other than bringing a combine to Las Vegas, I understand Deere played a larger role in this show. Could you tell us about that?
Yeah, so Deere, aside from having this demonstration inside, they also had an 8R series tractor out in the lot with at a ride and drive, or a ride and be passenger event, really is what it was. Other tech startups had robotic cars out there, but this, in Deere's case, showgoers were able to get into the cab of an 8R tractor and just let it go around this track. And then they were told that, unlike all those other prototypes, automotive displays that are going on, these machines are already doing this. They're out in the world, being steered by GPS, while the operator just, for the most part of the day, sits in the cab. And so that message was hammered home, that not only is artificial intelligence already at work in agriculture, but it's been at work for a long time. Also, there was an artificial intelligence panel at the show, and one of Deere's senior directors actually took part in that and was able to explain to the tech world how AI and digital technology is not only alive and well in agriculture, it has been for a long time, and the sophistication is increasing rapidly.
I can imagine that would be an eye-opener for folks who are kind of used to thinking about the bumpkins on the farm, you know, to see some of these really high-tech things. And that raises an interesting point. Deere, I noted in the story, also says there was a bit of a consumer agriculture education component to being there at the show. What did they have to say about that?
Yeah, so the Deere employees manning the exhibit had to actually explain what the combine was, what it did. They also had exhibits there of wheat and corn and other grains, and inform showgoers what these products became. So it was not only that information aspect that promoted agriculture in general, but it also promoted deer within the ag sector, or I'm sorry, within the tech sector, because Deer wanted to prove that it's a tech company. So you got to do that where the techies are. And it also gave computer engineers, software engineers, and other people that are in that industry a bit of a heads up to, hey, if you're looking for a job, why not come over to Waterloo, Iowa, or one of Deere's centers, and you can bring those unique skills that you have as a tech specialist into agriculture.
Well, that's great. Thanks for sharing that with us, Scott.
Thank you.
That was Glacier Farm Media Machinery Editor Scott Garvey telling us about John Deere's presence at the world's largest consumer electronics show. You're listening to Between the Rows, and I'm your host this week, Gord Gilmore. Later in the show, we'll be talking to Geraldine Witchers of the Manitoba Cooperator about the disappearing Red Barn, and Bruce Burnett of Markets Farm will fill us in on the markets. But first, here's Food in Canada editor Christy Nudds, who's going to tell us a bit about the challenges food processors face meeting Canada's much-hyped goal of growing agri-food exports. Christy, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Gordon.
So, government said they want to increase the export of agri-food products, but is this one of those things that's easier said than done?
I think so. It's a very ambitious target, and I think underlying the problem is that Canada historically has been an exporter of food commodities, so such as canola and wheat, rather than actual processed food products or manufactured food and beverage products. And meeting that goal is going to be difficult.
So then on the ground, what's the reality going to be of competing in these markets and growing these exports?
Well, again, because of our history of being a commodity exporter, there has not been a lot of investment made into growing Canada's value-added food sector. So nationally, our food sector is struggling. It is one of the biggest manufacturing sectors in Canada, however, sees the least amount of profits when compared to other manufacturing sectors. And a large reason for this is lack of innovation. Companies do not feel that Canada is a good bet economically for growth due to our reduced currency, again, this lack of innovation and lack of investment and increasing costs as well.
So, you know, in light of those issues, are there some stumbling blocks here that can be removed? You know, like what needs to happen then to address some of those?
Well, certainly research funding into investments and innovation needs to increase. There needs to be more discussion between the retailers and food manufacturers on how they can collaborate a little bit better to offset some of the costs that food manufacturers are facing. Because right now, retailers are suffering as well a little bit of the Walmart effect, where they don't want to pass on any of the increased costs that manufacturers have onto consumers or be seen as raising prices. And so therefore, manufacturers have to eat that cost. So if they can collaborate a little bit more on that, I think that would help in the long run.
So increasing exports, I mean, it's a laudable goal, but is this something that can be made to happen? Or is it one of those things where if it made any sense, it would already be happening?
I think the potential is definitely there. Canada, because we are so rich in commodities, right now plant-based proteins are really the wave of the future. I was recently, last week, at a show from the Institute of Food Technologists, and the majority of new products and ingredients at that show were plant-based proteins. And Canada certainly has the potential to be a huge player in that market, not only for exporting plant-based proteins, so I'm talking about pea, lentil, wheat, and canola proteins, but also to be a producer.
So when you say be a producer of these products, you mean a finished good rather than, say, a fractionated pea protein. You would make the burger that protein would go into?
Exactly. So there is the potential for innovation in Canada for Canadian companies to start producing their own plant-based alternatives using plant proteins. However, the infrastructure needs to exist. And currently, Canada does not have a large processing capacity for such proteins. However, recently, Burcon NutraSciences Corporation just made an announcement that they are building a $65 million plant protein processing plant in Western Canada, and Roquette is also planning to build a pea processing facility in Portage la Prairie, Manitoba.
So these are opportunities for our commodity crops. What about some of the other startups and so forth? You had talked about that a little bit earlier when we were getting ready for this.
Well, certainly, I've seen last month at the CL Canada show, which is a big food product and development show, the top 10 innovation finalists were products that were created in Canada. So there's no lack of food innovation happening right now in Canada. The problem is a lot of these small startup companies need funding to help them scale up. And some of the provinces in Canada do have food incubator programs that can help such businesses. However, how does this business scale up to the point where they can export outside of Canada? And that's where some expertise and guidance and funding is needed.
Well, thanks a lot, Christy. This has been very interesting, and it gives us here on the farm side of the equation a really interesting look at some facts and figures and so on that we wouldn't otherwise see. I very much appreciate it. That was Food in Canada editor Christy Nudds telling us about the food industry perspective on government goals to grow food exports from Canada. You're listening to Between the Rows, and I'm your host this week, Gord Gilmore. Just a bit later in the show, we'll be speaking to Bruce Brunette of Markets Farm about the latest in commodity markets. But first, we're joined now by Manitoba Cooperator reporter Gerilyn Witchers. Gerilyn visited recently with the owners of an iconic farm barn that are struggling with just what to do with it in the modern era. Gerilyn, thanks for taking the time to speak to us.
Yeah, for sure.
So tell us a bit about this barn and the family that owns it.
So the barn is owned by Jeff and Sheila Elder, who are grain farmers just outside of Wamanisa. And this is actually one of two barns that they have. So they have the one in question in the article is a sort of a classic red barn. And then they have another one on their original farm site that's a bit of a larger two-level white barn that's even older than the one in question in this article. And so this particular barn is, they call it an Eaton's barn, which is to say that back in the 1910 to the early 1930s, Eaton's would actually sell entire lumber and packages and so forth that you could just assemble an entire barn from. It wasn't pre-cut, but it was everything that you needed and the plans. And so as far as the Elder family knows, that's what this barn is. And so this barn was built, the barn was built in 1913 on a farm site close to the Elder's farm site by a Lamb family who then abandoned it in the 1930s, presumably because of hard times. And so Jeff Elder's family acquired that barn site in the 50s, and they used it for storing grain. And now it's not being used for anything. It's just standing there. It's in the middle of a barley field, quite a good field, they say. And it's just standing there, and they're rather attached to it, and they don't want to see it fall down, but they're not doing anything with it.
So what are they struggling then with in terms of what to do with this barn?
Well, the barn is in pretty good shape. The barn, like the timbers and so forth, are in good condition. It's got a tin roof on it, so that's doing pretty well. It's sitting on a concrete foundation, and that is cracked. So that won't last all that much longer. But other than that, it's a matter of what are they going to put into this barn to keep it standing. Their other barn on their farm site was built circa 1886. They've already put $50,000 into keeping that barn from falling down. It was sitting on tamarack piles, which had rotted off at ground level. And so they put that money into lifting it up, putting concrete and steel piles underneath to keep it from collapsing because, you know, it was built so long ago that they don't want to just let it go. Like, it's this barn that's made out of, like, squared off timbers with an axe. It's quite a one-of-a-kind barn. In the case of the red barn, you know, they've already put so much money into the other barn, they can't really justify spending a lot of money on keeping it up. And they're thinking, well, maybe we could make it into a venue here around Winnipeg. That's kind of a popular thing to do. But if they keep it where it is, they'd have to build a parking lot or something around it. They'd have to put in water and so forth, and they'd lose a portion of this field. So that's not really viable either.
So this really tells us something then about like the changing prominence of these of the barn and farm life, doesn't it?
I think it does. Like, so on that particular day, I drove from Winnipeg to Wamanese, and I saw a lot of these red barns. This is not, in some ways, it's not a unique barn, but it is kind of one of a vanishing breed. When these things were kind of in their heyday in the early 1900s, where they were being used for hay storage, grain storage, sort of a mix of livestock like milk cattle, milk cows, chickens, horses for working the farm, and farming has changed a lot, and so they don't need to use that, the barns for that anymore. One of the things I read when I was researching for this article was actually a thesis put together by a student from Newfoundland, and she had cataloged every single barn in two rural municipalities in southern Saskatchewan, 123 of them in total, and she found that 45% of them were still being used for storage and for livestock, and a full third of them were already so deteriorated that they were past the point of no return. They couldn't be restored. So yeah, they're falling out of use, they're slowly collapsing, and eventually they will be probably be mostly gone.
So you spoke about the elders and their attempts to sort of use this as an events venue, that sort of thing, and they're finding it a little difficult. What can you tell us about what they're doing there?
They've kind of done a couple of test events, or they tried to. One of them had to be canceled because of lack of interest. And then they also did sort of a farmer's market, flea market inside the barn. And as far as I know, that went fairly well. But on the whole, I don't think, my impression was that they didn't think it was going to be a very viable venue, because Wawanisa is fairly far from any large population center. And so what they told me is, like, most people are not going to drive on gravel roads to come see this barn.
So it's interesting. You talked about that work in the thesis and some of the numbers. Those are a little startling to me that, you know, a third of them would be essentially tear downs or burn downs at this point. Are we nearing the day when these structures will be approaching extinction?
Extinction, I don't know. Becoming an endangered species, probably. That's kind of what I was told. I spoke to Gordon Goldsboro from the Manitoba Historical Society, and he said, yeah, these are probably kind of, it's approaching the end of days for this kind of barn. But there are definitely a few people who are very interested in preserving them. So, I mean, they'll probably become a museum or a showpiece, and the odd one will be converted into something new.
Well, thanks, Geraldine. That's very interesting. That was Manitoba Cooperator reporter Geraldine Witchers filling us in on the struggle to maintain farm heritage buildings. You're listening to Between the Rows, and I'm your host this week, Gord Gilmore. Finally, last, but far from least, we're joined now by Bruce Burnett of Markets Farm. He'll make sense of the markets for us, as always. Bruce, thanks for joining us.
Good to be here.
So, now, this isn't something I follow closely, but even I heard about a USDA report. Tell us all about that.
Well, we received the June USDA report, the second, I guess, of this crop year. And most significant in the report was USDA revising their estimate of corn production. And what they did is they dropped yields 10 bushels an acre and production down just above 13 billion bushels. So that's a significant move. The market was not expecting it, and it helped provided some support for the markets here. The most significant part of this is that USDA tends to be relatively conservative and usually would wait into June or August after doing the farmer surveys to make big acreage and production changes, but they've decided to do it in June.
And is that a reflection of the sort of scope of weather challenges they've been facing then during the planting season?
Oh, most certainly. Again, at the first week in June, after the first week in June, they still had 17% of the crop left to plant. So there's a significant amount of corn acreage that obviously won't get planted. And that is going to be planted mostly will be planted later than they normally would. So that's the reason or the rationale behind the drop in yields. Just this late planting is going to cut into those eventual yields that we'll see on the corn crop.
Why did this come as a surprise to the market? I mean, to me, I would have thought that, you know, we've heard a lot of news about these weather challenges, and I'd have kind of expected it to have been largely priced in. What was different about the USDA report that made that move?
I think the difference was just that USDA tends not to do this. So I think the market was caught off guard by that. They were expecting yields to be dropped down into the low 170s and production reduced gradually, let's say, over the next few months. But this large drop, I think some market participants certainly view it. The USDA feels that this is a far more significant event than they had been anticipating.
So outside the U.S., then, what's this going to mean? What's the impact going to be on a producer in Western Canada?
Well, certainly for feed grains, it's going to make the situation globally a lot tighter. U.S. is the largest corn producer in the world. The U.S. corn crop is the largest single crop in the world. So it will have an impact, but it also has some other impacts as well. Wheat markets will be buoyed a little bit by this because wheat tends to follow corn as we go through the marketing year. And so a strong corn market is good for the wheat markets itself. We are going to have to see a significant amount of wheat feeding this year to help make up for the shortfall in corn because corn stocks are going to be dropping globally this production year.
So where are the beneficiaries of this going to be? Do we have any kind of ideas on that? If it's going to affect wheat, it'll back up into Western Canada, of course. What about some of the other global producers?
Well, the other global producers, the obvious ones are down in South America. And it's quite interesting, although the U.S. is the largest producer, production in South America has been growing steadily here. In the 18-19 crop year, they were about 40%, and that's Brazil and Argentina combined, would be about 40% of the U.S. production. But in that same crop year, they actually exported or are going to export more corn during that year than the U.S. by about 13 million tons. So you can see the emergence here of South America as a major supplier in the globe from just basically the expansion of acreage, especially in Brazil.
And now, of course, I'd be remiss to have you here talking about the markets and not ask you at least one question about this. Canola in China, has there been any movement on that front? What are you watching there?
Certainly, there's been no movement from China. Again, I think they're probably a bit distracted right now by the U.S. trade actions that they're seeing and the potential for additional tariffs. So Canada may be on the back burner here a bit, but certainly they haven't eased any of the restrictions. And we're certainly looking at a significant drop off here for the remainder of the crop year. Again, I would think that this probably remains in this situation until we either see some type of resolution at the diplomatic level or the release of the Huawei executive down the road here sometime.
Now, you know, you talked about the U.S. trade actions and so on, and that it raises an interesting question for me, and that is, it really does feel like we're kind of in an era where we're slightly turning away from our free trade era, and we're into something that's a little bit new. Do you share that at all, or where are you at with that?
Well, certainly, I think this idea that we were going to see freer trade as we move through the years has probably been derailed here for a while. The U.S. was the leader in this movement. Essentially, if you go back to it, to the Second World War, post-Second World War. And now you're seeing a significant change in U.S. policy. And that certainly is changing the policy, I think, of other countries. It's interesting to note that right now, because of the tariffs that U.S. has installed, they've become a rather high tariff nation compared to other participants, including Canada. So with their tariffs, almost double what Canadian tariffs are now on various goods. For agriculture, especially for an exporting country like Canada, this is not good news because, again, we can see markets almost disappear overnight by some arbitrary trade actions without a rules-based order in the globe. Even though that rules-based order was slow, at least you did get some progress.
So then in order for a sort of return to that, we're really waiting, hoping that we'll see U.S. leadership in this area reemerge?
I think that's probably the best hope, is that the U.S. will eventually decide that free trade, especially in agriculture, is something that they desire, and the imposition of sort of very random tariffs is not in their best interest. Of course, the U.S. is still a very major exporter, and it's in their best interest to have a low tariff environment globally.
Well, thanks. That was a very interesting discussion, Bruce. I appreciate you joining us. That was Bruce Burnett of Markets Farm helping us understand the markets. That wraps up another edition of Between the Rows. I'm your host this week, Manitoba Cooperator Editor Gord Gilmore, saying so long, and we'll see you next time.
Between the Rows is a production of Glacier Farm Media, Canada's leading farm publisher. We'd love to hear what you think of the show and invite you to send your comments to btr@farmmedia.com or visit us at membersgetmore.ca and sign up today.